Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today it's Bird News with Mark Faraday, science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Morning, Mark.
Yes.
Okay. We don't often use the term breaking news in bird news, but you got some news of a monumental find at Race Point yesterday. Tell us about that.
A monumental find. Yes. So we find out about rare birds various ways. There are like text message groups and Facebook and, you know, email groups and all that sort of thing. And this one was blowing up all of them. Amy O'Neill, who is a birder from Off Cape, was out at Race Point. She lives in somewhere in Eastern Mass, but is pretty regular, one of the regular birders out there, way out at Race Point in Provincetown. And yesterday she found an ancient murrelet. Yes, we've all heard of
it. I would say I've never heard of it before.
No one's heard of the ancient murrelet. You know, birders know of it. There are like three previous records. I think they were all in the 90s, weirdly. The 90s, kind of the late 90s, is when I sort of came online as a sentient adult birder just after college. And I remember the last record also at Race Point, I think 1998 or something like that, and nothing since. This is a Pacific, a North Pacific seabird, an alcid, so related to our puffin, our razorbills, our dovekies. We have several alcids that are regular here, mostly razorbills. but this is one. There are many species, like in the Aleutian Islands of Alaska, many, many species of alcids that breed in that area that we never see. And these guys breed in Asia as well, sort of the North Pacific, the Asian side. And it's a handsome little seabird, black and white. These alcids are, as I often say, they're the penguins of the north. They're penguins in every way except they can fly. You know, same kind of colonial breeding and, you know, mostly cold places. they basically fly underwater to pursue fish and small shrimp and things like that. So very penguin-like in every way, but all of these alcids of the northern hemisphere can fly. So no penguins in the northern hemisphere. And this one, not sure where the name came from. They claim it came from, it has this sort of gray mantle. The mantle is the upper back of a bird, sort of between the folded wings and the back of the neck. And it has this nice kind of black, white, and gray palette to it. Very, very formal looking. It's a seabird in formal wear. And it was just floating around there off the race, and we ran, I don't know, like a half mile up the beach, I think, to alert some of the other regular birders. And so various people got on it and got photos of it, and the word got out. People were instantly driving, you know, an hour and a half or longer, 2 hours to get out to Race Point and try for this bird because, yeah, fourth state record is a pretty big deal.
Yeah, like we've had some just really beautiful weather for November, and that may be contributing to folks wondering what happened to all their birds, right? I mean, this is very unusual to have this warm weather in November.
Oh, it's bizarre. It's very nice, isn't it?
It's beautiful. But, I'll take it.
But this is, you know, if you work at a nature center, you're a bird person, you get a lot of questions from people. And one of the top five is, where are my birds? My birds all disappeared. What happened to them? You know, as if I would know. It's a very local phenomenon, and sometimes there's really no good explanation for it. It's just something happening at the scale of somebody's neighborhood. but it's pretty widespread right now. I'm hearing about it, and I'm seeing it in my own yard. My birds. The bird activity in my yard at my feeders is way down. You know, the usuals still come by a few times a day, the mixed flock of chickadees and titmice and nuthatches that anchor most of the mixed flocks that people get in their yards. You know, they do their circuit, but when it's this warm, they have other options and they don't have the metabolic needs that they do when it's cold and they're feeling like they need to stock up. A lot of what the birds are taking from the feeders, they're just going and putting it somewhere. So I think this weather has them thinking like, oh, I can take a little me time, slow down a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
That's my semi-educated guess anyway. It just sort of makes common sense that, there's still insect activity, and they're just living the good life and don't need to hit the feeders as much, but they'll be back.
Yeah, and we're so possessive, aren't you? My birds. Where are my birds?
Right. My birds. Yeah. And if you follow them around, they're hitting feeders over a pretty big area, like multiple streets, like big, multiple neighborhoods in some cases. And you think of them as like, oh, they live in my backyard,
they belong to me.
In the cartoons, but not in real life.
Well, it's funny that how many years back when I had that yellow-breasted chat at my feeder in the middle of winter, I started going out and I was like pushing berries and stuff, trying to keep it at my feeders. And my neighbor started putting out some good stuff. I'm like, hey, stop stealing my bird, right? But the great little chat there got to go back and forth between these two yards with all this good stuff.
Yeah. Was there like a bird feeding arms race like you were getting?
It was like, stop stealing my bird.
Expensive cherry cordials and things like stay in my yard.
Exactly. So still warm, but we are seeing some early snowy owls and winter finches.
Yeah, it's so weird. It's just this incongruity, right? It's like shorts weather to almost a ridiculous extent given what time of the year it is. But these cold weather birds are early. All these winter finches that and we'll get into that. That's the big thing I want to talk about today because it's turning out to be a really big year for these eruptive northern forest species that we never know if we're going to see them in any given winter, which makes them fun. But we've had pretty much all of them have shown up at this point, and just in the last few days, like really new snowy owls seem to be moving south. I looked and I saw just a handful of reports along the coast of Maine, Hampton Beach, New Hampshire, Western Mass. A couple of Manomet researchers were on Monomoy, which used to be South Beach, part of the Barrier Beaches in Chatham there off the lighthouse, which is now a big part of Monomoy. They were there doing shorebird surveys and had two together. So that's a good sign. And so really just over the course of two or three days, all of a sudden snowy owls are popping up as far south as Connecticut. So people should be on the lookout at the usual places. Big barrier beaches tend to be the places that get them first. Those are the highest quality habitats if you're a snowy owl. Because they have access to ducks, which is mainly what they're eating down here. Typically are ducks hanging around the inlets and back bays and off the fronts of barrier beaches, and they can just sit there and pick out their dinner as dusk grows and then it gets dark. They go fly out over the water and pick off a duck or multiple ducks and eat them. And so, places like Sandy Neck and Nauset Beach and Race Point, I expect might start to get some snowies. And as always, don't be that dope. Don't be that person with the cell phone. Basically, those are the people who, if this was Yellowstone, those are the people getting tossed in the air by the bison because they got too close with their camera. Except this is a snowy owl, so all it can do is fly away. But don't be that person, creeping up too close to get a picture of the snowy owl with your cell phone at West Dennis Beach or whatever.
Leave them be.
Stay back. Get a telephoto. Don't affect their behavior and you'll be good.
Yeah. People love owls. I mean, of course, snowy owls are absolutely beautiful. But just speaking of owls before we move on to the winter finches, I have been lucky enough to have, I can hear the screech owl somewhere behind my house and a great horned owl somewhere in the front in the night. So I've got both that, and the, it's great.
Wait, my phone's breaking up. Could you do those imitations again?
I'm not very good. that's much better. That's much better.
Yeah.
It almost sounds like a horse whinnying, doesn't it? Yeah.
Oh, I The ghost of a tiny horse is what I always
say. Such a nice sound. I know. It's great. I love hearing them. Yeah.
And I listened to Robert Finch's piece earlier, and he's right. It's a terrible name. Screech. It's not a screech. And what about that noise is a screech. And
so
it's just a silly name. And a lot of birds are poorly named. But yeah, screech owls are wicked common. I mean, they're a common suburban bird. You know, they're like the American robin of predatory birds. As long as there's, a few deciduous trees, and they really like red maple swamps, and we have a gazillion red maple swamps, just pockets of them here and there, and even, in suburban neighborhoods here on the Cape. And so, they're very, very common here in any kind of eastern forest. And you can do even a pretty poor imitation can bring one in and let you know that there's one around. But it's always nice to hear them pipe up on their own.
Wow. And what about the great horned owls? They're more common on this end of the Cape, right? But not so much, or are they on the outer Cape?
They're everywhere. They're,
everywhere. Oh, they are.
Alaska to South America, deserts, it's everywhere.
Anywhere there's food.
Yes. They're just a very successful, very adaptable bird. And they, we have so many rabbits. They're big enough. I mean, they're a big owl. Snowy owl is the biggest owl that we get around here. They're heavier. They're just big. A snowy owl is a stronger, more serious bird than a great horned owl. Great horned owl is a little more feathers than bulk, but they're still a very big, strong bird that can take down a skunk, an adult skunk or a rabbit. And so not a lot of skunks around these days, but there's plenty of rabbits and other prey for them. Great horns are very common, and you can hear them over greater distances. They're certainly not as dense as screech owls on the landscape, but you can hear them from really far away. So I can't imagine there's too many people, if anybody, on Cape Cod who is out of earshot of a great horned owl territory.
Oh, good to know. 866-999-4626 is our number for your bird comment, questions, or stories, or other animals. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk about those winter finches after break. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News This Morning with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, Mark, tell us more about these winter finches.
Yes, this is a very exciting year. Every year for many years, there was a guy named Ron Pittaway, Canadian biologist up in Ontario, and he would put together a prognostication about populations of these northern boreal forest breeding songbirds and whether what their food sources were like heading into the fall across the boreal forest from basically sea to sea, and predicting whether they might come south into the U.S. And he retired, and there's a new guy named Tyler Hoare who does it. And now there's this whole finch research network that now has an official name and a website, and you can look them up, and they're doing some cool stuff. And so there was some hint that we might be seeing some of these birds, but we never really know in New England here what we might see or what numbers. But the first hint that it might be a good winter finch year was way back in August, when red-breasted nuthatches started streaming south from these coniferous cool forests up there in Canada. And that happened over a pretty long period. I mean, there's just way more red-breasted nuthatches than usual. They breed here on the Cape in our pitch piney woods. And so we have them year-round, but there's clearly way, way more this year. So that was a hint. And then purple finches started moving south. They seem to be around, and then the siskin invasion happened. Pine siskins, we definitely don't see numbers of them every year. A few kind of migrate through every year, but there was just a flood. It was clearly a almost historic eruption of pine siskins with, you know, people seeing over 100 at a time in a lot of places. And I saw a video of flocks of 150 or more just in people's yards, just all over the ground, just hoovering up their bird seed. And that's still, you know, ones that settled into bird feeders are still around. I'm hearing from people that, you know, they might have had 100 or more, and now it's down to 40 or something like that, but they're still around. And so, you know, they're responding to a cone crop failure somewhere to our north. You know, whether it's Nova Scotia or Quebec, I'm not sure. And then evening grosbeaks started, and this is a really rare one. I mean, first of all, it's a gorgeous bird. It's a big, substantial, you know, it's like sort of like a robin-sized bird with a short tail, bright, bright yellow, like if a goldfinch was robin-sized and with more colors. A male is pretty intense. The females are kind of like female goldfinches. They're more like vaguely yellow, but mostly gray. A huge bill. They're noisy. They will settle into feeders, especially if you have platform feeders or hopper feeders. They're kind of too big for some of the like tube style feeders. But these are birds that have a pretty strange history. They used to be fairly regular in the winter up until like the 70s. So kind of just before my time, like during my lifetime, they became rare in the winter, although they breed in very small numbers in Western Mass, weirdly. But they respond to some extent to outbreaks of a moth larvae in the boreal forest, the spruce budworm, that affects a lot of bird populations. And so it may be that a good spruce budworm outbreak in different places led to a big population increase in evening grosbeaks, and so now we're seeing them. And so maybe they're getting more regular again, because we had a small incursion of them in just 2 years ago, 2018. But this looks to be bigger and earlier and more widespread. So people should be looking for these at their feeder. Look them up online. Listen to what their calls sound like. It's a little tricky because they're the same shape as a starling, and they have some of their calls are sort of similar to calls that starlings give when they fly over. But, you know, if you're lucky, they'll descend upon your yard.
Well, here's a lucky one. Roberta writes, I had a flock of evening grosbeaks at my feeders this week. It was a first for me. Yeah, that sounds lovely. Yeah.
So that's what's happening. And so that's why these birds are cool. You know, I talk a lot about birds like an ancient murrelet. Very, very vanishingly small number of the people listening right now would even consider driving out to Race Point to see this bird they've never heard of. But these winter finch invasion, these are birds that meet people where they view birds, which is in their yards and at their feeders. And so most of these things that are coming south, they have at least the potential to be at a feeder. And so that's true of covered siskins. There are small numbers of common red poles mixed in with the siskin flocks and also just in their own flocks. And they are little streaky brown, a goldfinch-sized bird with a longer tail and a little red, subtle, but dark red cap. And so look for those mixed in with your siskin flocks. If you have siskin, they really blend in. But that's another cool bird. And they depend on willow catkins across the subarctic. And so if the willow catkins didn't produce a lot of seeds this year, then we'll see red poles further south, and we're seeing some. It's not a huge incursion, so people should be looking for those too, mixed in with those siskin flocks. The next two I have to mention are the crossbills, because the crossbills are just starting, and they're such cool birds. So red crossbills, a real flurry of reports just in the last couple of days. And so birders know to identify these by their flight calls. It's kind of chip, 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 chip as they fly over. And the cool thing about the red crossbills is that they may represent as many as 10 or 11 species. So we just all call them red crossbills, and there are different subspecies around the continent. Some of them don't move around very much, and others move widely from coast to coast looking for a good conifer seed crop. And when they find them, they might settle down and breed like way far away from their normal range. So they're really strange birds. They breed at strange times of year if there's a good coon crop. They have these crazy bills where the tips cross. It's evolved to allow them to get in and extract the seeds from pines and spruces and hemlocks. So different races have different subspecies have different sized bills that evolved with specific cones. Just really, really cool birds. And you can tell the subspecies apart by their call types with a sonogram. So if anybody comes across some crossbills, you can do some citizen science and get a recording with your phone of the flock or your camera. Take a video with your camera, and you can send those to some people from the Finch Research Network, Matt Young from Cornell, or Tim Spar, who's actually a Massachusetts guy, Cape Cod part-time. And they can tell you whether it's a Sitka spruce, you know, subspecies, or a western hemlock subspecies, or, you know, there's all these different ones.
Wow.
And both of those have already been recorded just in the last week. So it's just super interesting bird.
Yeah, so keep your eyes and ears out. All right, so let's talk to Peter, who's calling from Marion. Hi, Peter. Thanks for holding.
Good morning. I want to report a really neat bird that we've had in the yard the last 5 days, which is a female black-headed grosbeak, which is a beautiful little bird with it's got a pale orange breast and a white eyebrow, and it's a really neat bird, and it's been on our platform feeder consistently the last 5 days.
Well, that would be an extreme rarity. How did you conclude that that's what it was?
It absolutely is. Well, the conclusion came from the Eastern Bird Large Format Petey book, and then we looked it up online, and it's, absolutely...
Yeah.
Bad bird.
Black-headed,
no,
I don't think black-headed grosbeak would be in the Eastern Peterson. It's they don't really come
it is
except
east,
as an extreme rarity.
It's on page 254.
Peter, did you get
they
a
don't,
picture?
They don't occur in the east, so a more...
Well, let me read this to you. Black-headed grosbeak strays to the east from the west. Thickets appears on feeders. Female has a yellow or a buff chest with little streaking compared to the female rose-breasted. This is on page 254 of the Peterson Field Guide, Eastern Bird, large format edition.
Sure.
Peter, did you get a photo of that bird?
No, not at this
not
time, but
yeah.
Hopefully we will. But it's definitely that
right.
bird.
Well, that
no
would
question.
Be, that would be a super, super rare sighting.
Get that photo.
So a photo would be great because, you know, it's like once every 5 years maybe one would show up in Massachusetts, if that. It's not something you would expect, and you would have to distinguish it from a rose-breasted grosbeak, which is way, way more likely, difficult to distinguish in that plumage, but would also be uncommon this late.
Yeah.
The difference in the rose-breasted female is that there's striping on the breast. This breast is just totally orange with no barring or any other, and it's a pale orange. So, I mean, there's no question. And again, I have 8 feeders in the yard. We feed birds all the time. We got our first junco today. Virtually no question. And it's a tremendous rarity for me. You talked about grosbeaks. We used to live in South Jersey, and we had huge flocks of evening grosbeaks, which were wonderful. Mm-hmm. We were right on the edge of the Pine Barrens in Williamstown,
if you could get a photo, even a phone photo, like it's amazing. You'd be surprised how much you can tell from even not so great photo with a phone. But it would be great to document that. That would be a very nice.
Yeah, Peter, definitely get a photo so that, yeah, I mean, that, like you said, that would be a really great find. Lucky you.
Yeah.
Thanks for sharing.
It's a great bird, and, you know, we really pay attention to our birds all the time and feed them regularly. And so that is definitely what it is.
All right, Peter, thanks for sharing. Appreciate that. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Joe in Wacoit says, about 10 years ago, I became aware the Cape Cod is home to the American mink when I saw several while fishing at the canal. I've since seen one in Hyannis and one in Falmouth, both sadly roadkill. I heard that they were introduced at the canal to address a rat problem. I was wondering if that is true, or whether the minks are native to the Cape.
Yes, they're native. I hadn't heard they wouldn't have needed to be introduced. I mean, maybe somebody released some there, but they're broadly distributed throughout the U.S. They're not. Yeah, I'm sure they were here. You don't see them very often, but yeah, that population at the canal. And they're eating a lot of fish. I watched one. They scurry around in between the rocks, like by Scusset. And the only minks I've ever photographed in my life and career as a wildlife biologist was there at the canal in those rocks. They're really charming little members of the weasel family, and they dive for fish like an otter. They're like they have a much broader diet than an otter. They're smaller. They will eat rodents. Still, they can get into a chicken coop and stuff like that. But they tend to be associated with water. And I watched them diving and coming up with cunner in the canal. So they're pretty versatile, and that is a great place to see them. And I have not seen one anywhere else on the Cape, though I know others have.
Yeah, I've heard others too. You talked about in your bird report this week about the cuckoo spotted in Rhode Island. But for those who missed it, tell us about this cuckoo.
Yeah, boy, that makes the ancient merlet look common. So this common cuckoo, funny name from our perspective, is a European and Asian bird that typically would spend the winter in southern Africa. A few in southern India. And so they breed from basic eastern Siberia to western Europe. And then they long distance migrants, especially that eastern Asian population. They really, like, the longest distance migrating land bird, potentially. I mean, there are ones that migrate from Kamchatka, peninsula in eastern Siberia to Namibia in southwest Africa.
Wow.
Like 9,000 miles straight line, just crazy birds. And so this is the cuckoo, the cuckoo clock cuckoo, that's exactly what they sound like. Where the clock it came from is the European cuckoos, the German clockmakers
that's
a very familiar bird to them in the woodlands of Europe. And they're brood parasites, like our brown-headed cowbirds. They're basically obligate brood parasites. They only lay their eggs in other birds' nests. They're just really cool. The females will specialize in certain host species that they parasitize, and their eggs will mimic the host species' eggs. And they're cool birds in so many ways. And so this is, this was the third record for the lower 48 states. This bird that showed up, a week and a half ago at a little farm in Rhode Island, Johnson, Rhode Island. And some birder found this, just absolutely won the lottery, figured out it was a common cuckoo. There are some other similar species that you have to distinguish it from, but they're big. They're big and kind of hawk-shaped, and that's for a reason. It's because that helps them parasitize nests. They look like a sparrowhawk, which is a Eurasian bird that is basically like a sharp-shinned hawk, which we have around here. It's a bird-eating accipiter. And so they evolved to have the same kind of plumage and shape as a sparrowhawk. They have long wings. They're like barred on the front. But they eat the caterpillars. And the cool thing is this bird's pretty tired. He just flew in, and boy, are his wings tired. And he's just been nailing these caterpillars, and people are getting incredible photos of them. So if you go to the link to my bird report for last week, you could see some of these photos. Some of them are incredible.
Photo, yeah.
Eating like they eat big furry caterpillars that other birds don't eat. People are seeing them eating the woolly bears. You know, everybody knows right. The woolly bears that you see crossing the trails, black and orange. So they're eating those and eating this big sphinx moth caterpillar that was common in that field. This big fat thing with a horn at one end. They're just gobbling those down, and they smash them against something. It's kind of gross. They sort of smash the guts out of them and then eat them. It's good stuff. Good stuff. So lots of people were going to see every Cape birder I know, you know, went down to Rhode Island to see this bird. So there were big crowds down there at that little farm.
Yeah. I'll say the Serious Bird is putting some miles on the cars this week. Race Point to Rhode Island, right?
there's just so many rare birds, and you know, some tundra swans, just a flock of tundra swans just turned up on Nantucket, and that's a novelty to see a North American native swan species in New England. We just don't see them. You know, they're further right. west. We just have our mute swans, which are not native. So it's cool to see a native North American swan, and then spotted towhee, who's just found near Allen's Pond. That's in our listening area, down on the south coast.
All kinds of good stuff, yeah.
All right,
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. More bird news after a break. You're listening to The Point. It's bird news with Mark Faraday, science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, so Mark, we were at the playground over at T-Ticket Elementary School, and I'm like, what the heck is that on the other side of the field there? And as we got closer, it's a fake coyote. They have three fake yes. coyotes looking like they're about to pounce on something. Is that to scare away the geese?
Yes, exactly.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, there's a playground we go to at a elementary school in Brewster. They have those. It was fun to take Beckett over and look at the coyotes.
Yeah.
One of them is really scary. It's like a Halloween.
I think they're really scary looking. Yeah.
Yeah. It's good. I don't think the geese are that impressed, but it's like baring its teeth and, you know,
yeah.
it's going to kill someone. Yeah.
Yeah, same thing.
Not good PR for coyotes, but it's to keep the geese.
Okay, that's what I thought, but I wasn't sure. Yeah, I guess.
I don't know why they want the geese off the fields this time of year. They cut the grass and fertilize at the same time, but.
I don't know. You got the kids out there slipping and sliding
yeah, know,
and, you
know
goose gets, poop.
The poop
so,
gets to yeah. be too much, I know.
Yeah, especially with the numbers that you see. What about hummingbirds? Are we're still seeing hummingbirds? Yes or no?
No.
No, they're gone. Okay.
Yeah. They did linger longer than usual this year. There was somebody in Woods Hole who had up to two, like really late into October. But I have not heard of any. There was one report of, you know, it gets to be this time of year. I stopped thinking about ruby-throated. If somebody reports a hummingbird now, it's more likely to be one of the western species, like a rufous hummingbird, which is the kind of default species. They have orangey, rusty markings on them, either really bright in the unlikely event that it's an adult male, or more likely kind of subtle orange markings that a ruby-throated hummingbird wouldn't have, like on the sides of the breast and base of the tail, places like that, maybe a little bit on the back. If you do see a hummingbird this time of year, you know, get a photo, report it.
Yeah, for sure.
Because it's likely to be one of those vagrant hummingbirds from out west.
Got lost.
Yes.
Let's talk to Babette, who's calling from Falmouth. Good morning.
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 Hello.
Yeah, go ahead.
around sunrise, I take my dog out, and the last two mornings there's been many, many, many crows in the air going somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you know why and where they're going? You can hear them.
Yeah. So you don't, but this, this is just something you've noticed recently? It's not like a normal thing.
No,
to
I notice
here
it
at your house. Or...
Yeah, I notice it every fall.
Every fall, yeah. So there's crows flock up in the winter, and in your part of the world there, it's often a mix of American crows and fish crows. Most places in Massachusetts, the fish crows leave entirely. That's a crow species that their center of distribution is much further south, and they leave for the winter. They don't like our winters. But because I think in large part because of the Bourne landfill, the last uncapped landfill, there's a pretty good crow population in the Upper Cape, and fish crows are among them. And then there's a famous kind of commute of the crows between the vineyard and the mainland. So I'm trying to remember which way. I think they roost on the vineyard at night. In the theory,
yeah, I can't remember either. Yeah,
there's relatively few great horned owls. I think there's more great horned owls out there than there used to be. But and then they go to the mainland and spread out. So yeah, crows get into these big noisy flocks this time of year. So, you know, hundreds of birds.
Sometimes. Very noisy.
And west of like further mainland Massachusetts, like west of Boston on the North Shore, there are some epic crow roosts, like thousands and thousands and thousands of crows that draw people to look at them, like in cities. They like places that are well lit. They feel safe. And so there's, I'm trying to think, I think it's in Lawrence, is the huge famous crow roost this time of year. But we have smaller ones on the Cape. And,
thousands and thousands.
All,
that sounds loud.
Your yard. Yeah. What's that?
So thousands and thousands. That sounds loud.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. Violating all the city noise ordinances.
That's right. Yeah. Babette, thanks for the call. Let's talk to Lois, who's giving us a call from Truro. Hi, Lois.
Hello. How are you?
Good.
I'm calling about Carolina Wren. They're my favorite little bird, but I see them very seldom, maybe once a year. Now I see this little Carolina wren. Sometimes there are two, and they've been on my deck railing. And I'm wondering why, and maybe it's something that I have a lot of nasturtiums, the seeds. I don't know what they eat, and what would attract them?
Houses.
This is new to me.
Carolina wrens. Truro is kind of a funny place. You know, they tend to be more common in more densely populated areas. They're not a bird that likes big tracts of woods. They like houses, and for a variety of reasons. They like to hunt spiders and spider eggs and things like that that they can find year round at the, you know, at the base of your shed and under shingles and stuff like that. And there tends to be warmth around the bases of houses. They like to nest in people stuff like the tops of propane tanks and things like that. They're very comfortable around people, and they're year-round residents. Like, you either have them or you don't. They don't like migrate through or anything like that. They don't migrate at all. There's a little bit of dispersal of the young ones, I'm sure, but if they're in the neighborhood, they're in the neighborhood. And it's not, once you know what they sound like, they're like a little bird with a bullhorn. You know they're there.
mine have been singing.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
I have woods across the street from my house. It's all National Seashore. And now, since we've got COVID, there are a lot more people in Truro. So maybe, as you say, they're attracted to more housing. I don't know.
Yeah.
At any rate, this bird I've seen now for about a week and a half. And as I said, sometimes I see a couple of them. And it sounds as though they might even be coming here and stay. Is that what you're saying?
Mm-hmm. Maybe. Yeah. I mean, maybe you're getting a new resident pair. Yeah. Having the woods of the National Seashore there doesn't do you any favors when it comes to attracting Carolina wrens. You'd be better off in an overdeveloped suburb. They're not really feeder birds, but especially when it gets really cold or when there's some snow on the ground, they'll come to suet.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, listen, thank you very much.
Thank you for the call. Yeah. Good luck. All right, let's talk to Stephanie calling from West Barnstable. Hi, Stephanie.
Good morning. Yes, I have a question about a very mundane common bird, and I never thought I'd be asking this. I live in West Barnstable, and there have always been at least 30 mourning doves around my house. I noticed last spring the attrition of them. There are not that many hawks around, so what would be the reason for the attrition here, do you think?
Luck. I'm sorry.
I love the sound of a mourning dove.
Because there were so many of them before. It's just suspicious. I can't figure it out. All right, luck.
Yeah, I mean, this is the time of year they get into flocks and, well, late summer through now, and I don't know. I don't have a good sense of they fly long distances.
They do.
When you see a bird flying fast as it gets toward dusk, it's almost always a mourning dove.
They're leaving.
So they
fly somewhere to
feed, and then they'll fly a pretty long distance back to where they roost. So, you know, they're using a broad area. So I don't know if it's necessarily something in your yard.
I've been here for 23 years. I've been here, and they've been like clockwork all the time. So to see them gone. And the other question, which I can't be more specific, over at Long Beach at Craigville, a group of, I want to call them grebs, but they're black and white diving into the water. They look like Canadian birds. They're smaller than eiders. What would they be? I have to look in my bird book. There are about 30
maybe
of them.
Buffleheads.
That's what I was thinking, buffleheads maybe?
No, they're not buffleheads. I know that they're smaller. They're smaller than buffleheads.
Literally nothing is smaller than buffleheads that you would see diving on the water. No, they're like bathtub toys. Yeah.
Okay, so that's what they are from Canada, right?
Yeah.
Come down from Canada. All right. Well, that I guess that's it.
Stephanie,
I have to live with the thing of.
They'll be back. Don't worry. They'll be back. Stephanie, thanks for the call. Katrina's calling from T-Ticket. Hi, Katrina.
Hi, good morning. I'm having such a feeling of deja vu because the last time I called in was February or March, and I had called about mourning doves, and I got a similar sort of dismissive response from Mark Faherty about mourning doves at that time. And I'd also called at that time about the crows because somebody had asked where the crows were commuting. So I had called in February to say that my observation from living, I used to live on the vineyard for many, many years, and at this time of year anyway, they commute from the vineyard to the Cape, and you can see them flying over by the, you know, 400 or 500 at a time at dusk.
Right.
So that's my observation.
Right.
They go from the vineyard to the Cape.
Okay,
so
you answered that question. That's what you thought, Mark, but we weren't sure.
Yeah, that's how I remember it. And the thinking was always that it's safer over there because there's not as many, or I don't know if there used to be any great horned owls. They're over there now, though.
Oh, no, I'm saying they roost on the Cape. They're leaving
the other way.
Night.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Oh.
They fly from Vineyard Haven. If you're in Vineyard Haven, you can see them flying across Buzzard's Bay towards the Cape at dusk.
Oh, interesting.
Leaving
interesting.
The vineyard. Yeah.
Okay. Katrina, well, thank you for answering that question for us. Well, there's something yummy over there on the vineyard.
I've seen. Yeah.
And thanks for the call.
It's one of those things that I learn every year and then forget, and obviously I got it backwards again.
Perfect.
I want to, while we're talking about mourning doves, I want to tell my quick mourning dove story.
Go ahead.
The other day I looked at the end of my deck on the ground to find this classic suburban crime scene with just a spray of mourning dove feathers on the ground where a Cooper's hawk took one out. And there were two, and this was fun to look at with my son, and there were two, there was like a kill zone and then a pluck zone. So you could see where this Cooper's hawk, I'm sure, there's been up to two around pretty consistently in my neighborhood. So there was like this initial place where the kind of outer feathers had been plucked, you know, in a secluded spot, and then it moved into a more open area and did the rest of the plucking. So it's just, it's always mourning dove feathers. It just seems to be like the most common prey item for a Cooper's hawk. Just this pile of gray and light brown, you know, mourning dove feathers.
It's just because they're going about their business and they're not paying attention, maybe, right? You say they're not the smartest bird. Maybe they're just like, whoop,
that prey.
Didn't see that hawk coming, right? You know, I saw something interesting maybe a week or two ago. I usually have a pretty good number of blue jays in my yard, but I was at a doctor's appointment in Falmouth and just kind of sitting in my car waiting for my turn. And there were literally at least a dozen blue jays feeding on the ground in front of me. And I thought, wow, that seems like a lot at one time. Is it just a good year for blue jays?
Yeah, it seems to be. And so they're variable, and they're, you know, we talked about those northern finches. They're eruptive. They're evaluating certain seed crops in the boreal forest and making a decision to keep going and come south where we can see them. And the blue jays are looking at what they call the hard mast crops, which is acorns and further north beech nuts. We don't have a ton of beech. So in the Outer Cape, we have essentially none, but further north, beech are an important component of the forest. And if you have a beech and acorn crop failure, they'll keep going. And we seem to have a lot of acorns. They seem to be pretty consistent around here, the acorns. But there
was this year for sure, yeah.
This year, definitely. There was a year where there wasn't. I'm trying to remember when that was. There was a winter within the last 10 years where I distinctly remember there were, like, literally no blue jays. It just conspicuously absent, as you'd say, because they're so, you know when they're around. They're not subtle when they come into your feeder, especially when there's a lot of them. But yeah, so it seems to be plenty of food for them this year, and maybe more than usual even.
Even when we don't have the acorns, I still have them in my yard. I don't remember what year that was, but I remember that we still had it. We always have at least a few in my yard every year. Yeah, which is, I mean, they're like you said, a little bit of a bully to the other birds, but they are beautiful birds.
Yeah, so that, you know, we take our common backyard bird for granted sometimes, or some of us do. And I remember being in a study abroad program in college in East Africa, and one of the professors was a bird guy, and he was from South Africa, and he was going on and on, oh, the blue jay. You guys have the blue jay. It's beautiful. And, they're in Southern Africa, the best birding in the world. It's nice to see what we consider the banal, you know, through someone else's eyes.
For sure, yeah. Now, we got about a minute and a half left. So for folks who haven't put the feeders out yet, any advice?
Putting out the feeders? Yeah. Put them out. Try a platform feeder. They have these hanging platform feeders, or you make your own, where, you know, it just needs to have drainage so you're not giving them birdseed soup. And that's something that will attract, if evening grosbeaks are going to settle in, that's going to be places with like a good size hopper feeder, like I said, or a platform feeder. It's a little harder to keep the squirrels off of those, but and then, you know, consider putting out some of that Niger seed, the thistle seed, we used to call it, but it's actually seed from an African plant, for the pine siskins. I don't know if we missed the window for those to settle in at feeders, but probably not. There's still some moving around, I think. But yeah, you can try some different things, because it's clearly a very interesting feeder bird winter. So get your stuff out and wait for the show to come to you.
All right. Mark Faraday, science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary, joins us the second Tuesday of every month. Thanks, Mark.
All right. See you next time.
I'm Indy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.